Today is March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexiou in Washington. Coming up, the death toll from the landslide at a massive garbage dump in Ethiopia's capital has climbed to more than 60 people. This will be a defining moment for the whole country, says the Prime Minister of Britain, who addressed Parliament today on the way to Brexit.
We will be a strong, self-governing, global Britain. With control once again over our borders and our laws.
Also ahead, damage estimates for Syria's ravaged infrastructure vary from $300 billion to $1 trillion. And 3.14 trending stories online today. Stick around, it's all on today's International Edition. British Prime Minister Theresa May addressing Parliament today, a day after lawmakers gave her approval to begin Britain's exit from the European Union. May told the lawmakers still awaiting one final step, the consent of Queen Elizabeth, and that could come very soon. After that, she'll be free to formally notify the EU. She's triggering Article 50 of the bloc's treaty, which covers how a member can withdraw. May spoke of the historical significance of the move.
This will be a defining moment for our whole country as we begin to forge a new relationship with Europe and a new role for ourselves in the world. We will be a strong, self-governing, global Britain, with control once again over our borders and our laws. And we will use this moment of opportunity to build a stronger economy and a fairer society, so that we secure both the right deal for Britain abroad and a better deal for ordinary working people at home. And, Mr. Speaker, the new relationship with the EU that we negotiate will work for the whole of the United Kingdom.
Anne-Marie Elijah has been watching the Brexit process from her vantage point at the Australian National University Centre for European Studies and spoke earlier with VOA's Victor Beatty.
And so what we've seen in the past couple of weeks is some parliamentary ping-pong, as they call it, between the Lords and the Commons, and eventually the outcome that a lot of analysts had predicted, which was that it would go through without amendments. So now what we see is the kind of formal beginning, if you like, of the actual Brexit process. And I guess in some ways this is where we move from a kind of theoretical proposition to something that's actually deeply practical, and that is the beginning of the negotiations once Article 50 is triggered.
Well, the House of Lords was concerned about guaranteeing the rights of EU nationals living in Britain and giving lawmakers more power to reject the final terms of the deal reached with the EU.
Exactly, and those two amendments were, in the end, both then voted down by the Lords once they realised that it would not, in fact, pass the Commons with the amendments. But those two issues remain an ongoing concern. Now the question becomes, at the end of this long period of negotiation that we will see once Article 50 is triggered, how much of a role does Parliament have in the final text or the final agreement between the UK and the EU27, and of course, for the purposes of those EU nationals over whom people are arguing, what is going to happen to those people and when will we know the outcome for them? But these, of course, are just two issues in a whole suite of things that have to be sorted out in the course of negotiations.
Does the EU have to pass its own legislation saying that the two-year period of Brexit has begun?
Council President Donald Tusk has already indicated that the EU will respond quite quickly once the UK government formally triggers Article 50. And most people think that the process from here on in will involve a formal convening of the European Council once more in order to set forward with a negotiating mandate and so on. But it does depend a little bit on Prime Minister May's timing, because there is already an informal council, a non-summit, if you like, of the EU27 scheduled for the very end of March, the 25th, in fact. And that signals the end of a process that's called the Bratislava process, whereby the 27 are thinking about the future of the European Union in relation to Brexit and indeed a suite of other challenges.
That is Anne-Marie Elijah at the Australian National University Centre for European Studies. Now, one challenge the Prime Minister faces is Scotland and its threat to hold a second independence referendum as early as next year. Anne-Marie Elijah said that that threat is real, but so are the obstacles of borders, EU membership and independence from the United Kingdom. Scottish voters turned down independence in 2014. This is the Voice of America. On now to what's trending today. Social media master Andrew Pachesky is here to bring us up to date. And interesting call today. 3.14 stories, you say.
Yes.
Never heard that.
We'll explain that in just a minute. But first, let's get right into it with the trending stories. Trending throughout yesterday and into today, the Republican health plan. Of course, this is the plan that they proposed to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And it's trending because the Congressional Budget Office has released their estimate of the coverage. They had been what they call scoring this bill, looking at how it shakes out in terms of how many people are covered and how much money is going to be spent. And so they've come out and said that under this plan, 14 million fewer people will be insured, and by 2026, that number will grow to 24 million people that will be fewer insured under this new plan, but that it'll also decrease the budget deficit here in the U.S. by about $350 billion. So you have a lot of debate on social media over this, people questioning if the CBO's estimate is accurate. People questioning why the Republicans would propose a plan that would supposedly eliminate insurance for people, and then also people talking about that over $350 billion, saying what a savings that is, and that you have to balance these things out to save that kind of money. So it is a big debate over policy, as we've talked about on the show. People have gone online to read the bill. There's been a big push on social media to promote it. And now the debate continues with this Congressional Budget Office estimate.
Yeah, and we have been hearing about the CBO's estimates in the past, and I think some of the Republicans have been complaining that, hey, you know, they have been wrong, and there's been sort of a debate about that, sort of defending, look, that's what the CBO says, so they're not always right, and we disagree with those numbers. Is that how that's going?
Yeah, it's a lot of people coming out and saying, well, this is just one way to look at it. This is one organization that's scoring this bill, that's looking at this bill. But the flip side of that, a lot of people noting that the Congressional Budget Office director was appointed by Republicans. So, again, that back and forth continues and will continue for the duration of this bill.
It is complicated. Yes. Okay, so something else going on. What have we
Yes,
here?
Hashtag snow day.
Snow day,
a lot of snow here in the northeastern United States, all the way up through New York and Boston, getting hammered up there. A little less here in the Washington, D.C. area. But a lot of people off from work, so they're celebrating that on social media. Unless, however, you work in law enforcement or work at a hospital or, like you and me, work here as journalists, we have to come into work.
Essential employees.
Yes, essential employees. So a lot of people bemoaning the fact that they don't get off from work today because of the weather. But a lot of people sharing, you know, safety tips for shoveling, that kind of thing as well. And like I said, and you said at the top of the show, 3.14 stories. That's because today is March 14th. 3.14, as we write it here in the U.S., we do the date as the month and then the day. So 3.14, which is Pi Day. Of course, pi is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. 3.14159265 ... On and on forever. So people celebrating pi as a mathematical entity, talking about the importance of everything for space exploration, engineering, everything, including radio transmissions, by the way, using pi to determine that. But also P-I-E, pie, so pizza pie, apple pie, blueberry pie, kind of the informal holiday celebrating the food
as well. Those are the kinds of pies that we know a lot about.
Yes.
How high did you go in math, may I ask, in school?
I became a journalist instead. Let's just leave it at
okay,
that.
Okay, yeah, you're with me. But, you can understand the English language better than math,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And since we said 3.14 stories, very quickly, the 0.14, one line, March 14th, also celebrating the birthday of Albert Einstein. He would have been 168 years old today. So happy birthday to him. A lot of people celebrating that on social media as well.
Excellent. A lot of stuff going on there. All right. VOA social media reporter Andrew Pachesky, thanks a lot. Stick around. We got more to come.
This is Science in a Minute.
When we see someone yawn or scratch an itch, sometimes we can't help but respond in kind. For many years, many scientists have thought that this behavior was an empathic or psychological response. A new study by researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine proposes that the mimic scratching response is controlled by chemicals released in the brain. In the study, researchers showed mice videos of other mice scratching themselves. The scientists noticed that the videos evoked a similar behavior in the live mice. The scientists then found that whenever a mouse saw another one scratch, a chemical called GRP would be released by a part of its brain that controls wake-sleep functions. When the researchers blocked the GRP in the mouse brain, they found that mice would no longer mimic scratching behavior as observed in video. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump planning to host the Chinese president for a two-day summit next month. A seized oil tanker with 8 crew on board anchored off Somalia. Iraqi troops push to retake Mosul from the Islamic State. And Britain attempting to defuse Afghanistan's tensions with Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. 7 staff members for U.S.-based Christian humanitarian aid organization Samaritan's Purse were released from their detention by armed personnel Tuesday in South Sudan's famine-stricken area of Mandit and had been flown from Unity State to a safe location. Samaritan's Purse Vice President of Programs and Government Relations Ken Isaac says local officials arrested them on Monday. A request, he says that the opposition forces and those loyal to the government warned that his organization 2 weeks ago that they were preparing to fight, so Samaritan's Purse then evacuated between 12 and 15 foreign and South Sudanese aid workers who were not from Mayandit. Isaac also clarifies that despite some prior reports to the contrary, the situation was a detention and not a kidnapping. The death toll from the landslide at a massive garbage dump in Ethiopia's capital has climbed to more than 60 people. The Ethiopian government media saying that at least 62 people died in the weekend disaster, while Addis Ababa Mayor Dariba Kuma put the death toll at 65, including 20 men and 45 women. Facts and figures are often difficult to verify in the Middle East, but estimates for the cost of rebuilding Syria's ravaged infrastructure vary from $300 billion to $1 trillion, and most experts agree that the task of repairing the damage from 6 years of war will not be easy. At least half of Syria's pre-war population of 23 million has been displaced, 6 million internally and another 6 million outside the country. No matter how daunting the challenge, though, some Syrians are eager to start rebuilding, as Ed Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Despite the absence of a comprehensive peace accord in Syria, bulldozers remove rubble from streets in Aleppo, and some tenacious residents have already started to patch up the damage from 6 years of sectarian conflict. Last month, the Syrian government reopened one leg of an Aleppo rail line as travelers besieged the city's main rail hub. Transport Minister Ali Hamoud told journalists that it took a good deal of effort, but that progress is being made. He says that 1,730 meters of metal rail, 780 cement ties, and 220 wooden trestles were used to restore the abandoned rail line, along with the removal of 330 explosive devices that militants had placed along the tracks. Despite the gloom in many quarters, Syrian Prime Minister Imad Khamis tried to be upbeat during a recent impromptu visit to Damascus' venerable Hamadiya-covered market. He says that his government wants to work with both the largest and the smallest of the country's entrepreneurs in order to help them to resume production. As two separate rounds of peace talks drag on in Geneva and the Kazakh capital Astana with limited progress, a battle-hardened but still resilient President Bashar al-Assad insists that his forces will regain control of the country and rebuild it.
سوريا مصممة على استعادة كل منطقة من الإرهابيين على إعادة الأمن والأمان على إعادة الأعمار.
He tells his supporters during a brief visit to a Damascus suburb recaptured by his forces that he is adamant about chasing militants from all areas they occupy and rebuilding everything that has been destroyed in addition to restoring security. U.S. and European Union economic sanctions must also be lifted before money from some of Syria's former trading partners can pour in to invest in new infrastructure. Iran, which has given Syria loans or credits of anywhere from $5 to $10 billion, according to some estimates, is vying for a number of economic and industrial concessions. China, which once ran the Haiyan oil fields, is looking to rebuild destroyed energy facilities, while India has agreed to help build a $25 million electricity plant, according to Syrian media. Former Syrian Deputy Prime Minister Abdullah al-Dardari, who now works for the World Bank in Washington, told the Associated Press last month that much of the damage to Syria's architectural treasures and historic sites, including parts of Aleppo, is incalculable.
How can you put a number to the loss of the old town, the old bazaar? There is no number on earth that could be put on the loss, the historical and archaeological and cultural, and also the business aspect of it.
Dardari points out that he and his associates first began drawing up plans to rebuild Syria nearly 3 years ago, joking that many people thought that he was mad. But he argues one day soon, hopefully, when there is a peace agreement of some sort, we will need to deliver to the people of Syria on basic services, housing, and schooling. But he says he doesn't see Syria going back to normal without the return of the 6 million Syrians who have left the country. For many of those émigrés, though, psychological scars run deep, and it may take years before some of them are willing to return. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Some good news in the medical world. German researchers say they've developed a clinical study they found out in a clinical study a highly effective anti-malaria vaccine that could be ready for use in as little as 2 years. Now, by making the vaccine with an entirely new approach, Peter Krinsmer at the University of Tübingen says patients were given parasites at the same time as an anti-malaria medicine, and so this made the vaccine 100% successful. Krinsmer says that his research group believes that they can now carry out further studies to refine the concept and offer it for travel vaccinations and later for use in Africa following wider field testing. Malaria killed over 400,000 people in 2015, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, this month marks a notorious anniversary for the rap music world as VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and VOA's Jim Stevenson talk about a big murder mystery.
That's cargo, my cargo, 160, swiftly, wreck it by a new one, the crew run, the crew run.
It's a tragic anniversary, the 20th anniversary of a murder that is still talked about to this day. On March 9th, 1997, Christopher Wallace, a rapper known as Biggie Smalls or the Notorious B.I.G., was fatally shot after leaving a Vibe magazine party at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. That murder remains unsolved, and it came 6 months after the similar shooting death of fellow superstar rapper Tupac Shakur in Las Vegas, and that murder also remains unsolved, and both of these killings have given rise to many conspiracy theories, because people just aren't talking. One theory says that now imprisoned Death Row Records founder Marion Suge Knight ordered Wallace's death in retaliation for Tupac's murder, which was orchestrated by Sean Puffy Combs, who was the head of Wallace's label, Bad Boy Records. Now, Combs has always maintained he had nothing to do with the murder. This was a bi-coastal feud between rappers from New York and the West Coast, notably Los Angeles. It just sort of built on itself. It was like a gangster movie that got out of hand, and a lot of inflammatory lyrics and back and forth. And it ended in these two tragic murders. The Los Angeles Times a few years ago ran a series reporting that the Crips had killed Shakur in a hit orchestrated by Christopher Wallace. Suge Knight had ties to the Crips' rivals, the Bloods, so the gangs were supposedly involved in this. And the investigation also reached into the Los Angeles Police Department, with allegations that more than 70 officers in the anti-gang divisions were guilty of crimes including shootings, beatings, and planting evidence. So as the investigations broadened, they just grew more and more all-encompassing, which gave rise to even more conspiracy theories that maybe this was just the tip of a very corrupt iceberg. Making the whole thing more difficult were the relationships between the rap community and law enforcement. There has always been mistrust, which continues to this day. So there weren't a lot of witnesses. There weren't a lot of people talking. And so you had this veil of secrecy.
A defining moment in the history of rap music, and certainly what has followed since.
The deadliness seemed to sort of dissipate after these two murders. I think it shocked everyone so much. The murders have inspired books and movies. An upcoming TV series called Unsolved is coming from Anthony Hemingway. So these murders, which may never be solved, still continue to dominate the public's imagination. Notorious B.I.G. died 20 years ago, March 9th, 1997.
While people aren't talking about these unsolved murders, we talk all the time. Ray McDonald presents the Top 20 Countdown each and every week on VOA 1.
And you can also catch my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me. And I just love your flashy ways. Guess that's why they're broken, you're so fake.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. You can also like us on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks to our director, Felicia Butler, and engineer, John Dryden. I'm Philip Alexio here in Washington. We'll see you tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a world where national security is increasingly dependent on close cooperation with like-minded governments, the United States is working with longtime partners and forming new and innovative partnerships to advance our mutual security goals. The U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Political and Military Affairs links together the U.S. Departments of State and Defense, the Congress, and the U.S. defense industry in a combined effort to help improve the security capabilities of our allies around the world. We do this by providing them with the tools and training necessary to effectively respond to even the most dire of security challenges. We work worldwide, helping Iraq and our coalition partners to make gains against ISIS, supporting nations across Southeast Asia to safeguard their territorial waters, and standing with our partners across Africa against terrorists like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, among other challenges. David McKeeby, public affairs officer at the Bureau of Political and Military Affairs, wrote in a recent blog post, "To help achieve this goal, the Bureau of Political and Military Affairs oversees some $6 billion in security assistance programs that are meant to help our partners invest in U.S. training and in U.S. manufactured equipment. At the same time, the Foreign Military Sales System, a foreign policy tool that acts as a form of security assistance, allows the United States to transfer defense equipment and services to our partners worldwide. Any such transfer first goes through a sensitive vetting process, because before a sale is approved, the U.S. government must carefully weigh a wide range of factors to ensure that such transfers of often sophisticated, top-of-the-line U.S. military equipment are consistent with U.S. foreign policy. Finally, the Lead Nation Procurement Initiative allows our NATO allies to transfer to other NATO members military equipment purchased from the United States. Thus, the United States and its allies can maintain flexibility, keep down costs, yet still retain the ability to keep track of the equipment. While we may not know what next major international security challenge may emerge, wrote Public Affairs Officer David McKeeby. You can count on the United States' continued commitment to taking action, strengthening our allies and partners, and safeguarding America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.